2002 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 352, Farms Redux, Why Don't Trust Farms Research, a paper presented by Earl M. Wunderly, with a response by Kevin Christensen.
Disparaged you, John. This is John Hatch.
I came in at the right time.
Yes. John Welch, the founder of Farms, discovered chiasmus in the Book of Mormon in 1967 while on a mission in Germany. All I know about chiasmus I have learned from him. Chiasmus is inverted parallelism. A good example is the first shall be last and the last shall be first. Now if you take these two statements and put them on one on top of the other, last shall be first and the first shall be last, and you draw a line from between the two lasts and the two first, they cross, it becomes an X, and X is chi in Greek, and thus chiasmus. Simple chiasms are common in English. Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country, as well as other languages. But complex chiasms were an ancient Hebraic literary device and thus distinguish ancient Hebrew writings from other ancient writings. Complex chiasms comprise a series of elements, not just two, but more than two. Elements A, B, C, D, E is how they're generally displayed, coming down to a center, either one line or a simple chiasm in the center, and then coming back the other way, E prime, D prime, C prime, B prime, and A prime. In his first article on chiasmus in 1969, Welch identified 9 complex chiasms in the Book of Mormon and has been discovering more ever since. As he lays them out and discusses them, they are impressive. But having looked closely at his chiasms, I am as little impressed as he is enthusiastic. I will discuss but 2 examples, the Mosiah chiasm and the Alma chapter 36 chiasm. Now, Welch has constructed an impressive chiasm covering virtually the entirety of the Book of Mosiah, consisting of elements A through N, and then in reverse order, N prime through A prime. My analysis suggests that, like Procrustes, who stretched or cut his victims to fit his iron bed, Welch has artificially fit the Mosiah text into a chiastic form. There is much arbitrariness in how he describes the elements and in what he includes and excludes. For example, in his first element A, which opens the Book of Mosiah, the first element he describes as King Benjamin exhorts his sons. And his last and matching element, A prime, is Mosiah exhorts his people. These paired elements exemplify 3 problems with his chiastic construct: imbalance, creative labeling, and ignored text. Imbalance is evidenced by pairing the 8 verses of element A with the 28 verses of element A prime, and he cites the verses that he identifies for these elements. These 8 and 28 verses are so dissimilar that they are paired only by creatively labeling them as exhortations, even though the word is used in neither element. Very often, chiasms are constructed with the actual language of the text. And following the last element, A prime, the Book of Mosiah continues for another 15 verses, but these are completely ignored in the chiasm. One would think that if the author of a book intended it to be a chiasm, he would include the last 15 verses. There are other problems as well, such as asymmetry. For example, element B is labeled Mosiah chosen to succeed his father, and element B prime is labeled Judges chosen instead of a king. Chiastically, since Mosiah is chosen to succeed his father in element B after Benjamin's exhortation in element A, Judges should be chosen in element B prime before Mosiah's exhortation in element A prime, because they go in reverse order. But judges are chosen after rather than before Mosiah finishes his exhortation. Chiastically, it is asymmetrical. But it is not obvious from Welch's chiastic layout, since he cites the same 28 verses for both B prime and A prime. Undue selectivity is still a fifth problem. For example, element D consists of 105 verses, including Benjamin's speech to the people and an angel's prophecy of Christ, all of which Welch labels Benjamin's speech and the words of the angel. Angel is italicized. Element D prime consists of Mosiah chapters 26 and 27, or 76 verses, and tells the story of the rebellious youth, including Alma Jr., and I call him Alma Jr. Alma Younger is the normal terminology, but he was the son of an Alma, so I call him Alma Jr., and the four sons of Mosiah and their conversion. Somehow D prime must be paired with D, and so it is labeled the words of Alma and the words of the angel of the Lord. Even though Alma's prayer to the Lord for guidance and an angel's appearance to Alma Jr. are just two of many parts of these two chapters that could have been selected as elements if they could have been paired with something in the 105 verses of element D. Angel is again italicized as apparently the only commonality in these two long, disparate accounts covering nearly six chapters. Every pair of elements in the Mosaic chiasm can be similarly challenged as ignoring much text or as being creatively labeled, highly selective, unbalanced, or occasionally asymmetrical. Such shortcomings suggest not that the chiasm was intended by the writer, but that it was imposed on the text by a reader. Now, Welch could well believe that to impose chiasmus on a text where the writer intended none is highly unlikely. And so for a test, I selected the Book of Omni, because it was written by five different men over a period of about 231 years and was not abridged by Mormon and is thus probably the least likely book in the Book of Mormon to constitute a complex chiasm. Yet chiasmus can be imposed on the Omni text, consisting of elements A through P, and then in reverse order, P prime through A prime. It is at least as good an example of complex chiasmus as the Mosiah chiasm, although you'll have to take my word for it. It is in my paper, though, which isn't yet published. There is no imbalance and little ignored text. It is symmetrical, and selectivity and creative labeling are minimal. Now, in 1982, that was in 1969, in 1982, Welch included an essay on chiasmus in Book of Mormon authorship, New Light on Ancient Origins. This was my first introduction to chiasmus, and I analyzed each of his eight examples and found the same problems. I hypothesized that Welch may have identified a possible kernel, perhaps a simple chiasm, looking through the text and looking for some simple chiasm, and then worked out from it, trying to pair elements on each side of it to construct a complex chiasm, and he wrote up his successes. I tested this hypothesis on Joseph Smith's description of the first vision, and quickly coming up with two complex chiasms, the first covering his account from his being seized upon by some power to being delivered from the enemy that bound him to contrasting elements in this case, which is acceptable under the chiastic rules. And the second opens and closes with his being forbidden to join any of the sects. If either was from the Book of Mormon, it could well have been used as an example of this ancient Hebraic literary form. In this collection was the Alma chapter 36 chiasm, which Welch has termed a masterpiece. Again, it is impressive until examined closely. It is the first of two chapters in which Alma gives commandments to his son Helaman. The Mosiah chiasm covered 29 chapters, whereas the Alma 36 chiasm covers but one chapter consisting of 30 verses. Now, unlike the multiple verse elements of the Mosiah chiasm, the elements of the Alma 36 chiasm often consist of phrases from the text, as chiasms are generally constructed. So the weaknesses of creative labeling and imbalance are largely avoided, although not entirely. The much more common problems are of ignored text, asymmetry, and selectivity, and often work together. For example, elements A and A prime, the first and the last elements, pair. My son, give ear to my words, that's verse 1, with this according to his word, or God's word, verse 30. There is no apparent commonality in a relationship between the two statements other than the terms words and word. Now, Alma also tells Helaman in verse 3, just as he did in verse 1, to hear my words, as he does in verse 1. But the words phrase in verse 1 has been selected for the chiasm. The words phrase in verse 3 is completely ignored in the chiasm, and symmetry is achieved. Similarly, Alma also refers to the Lord's word in verse 26, as he does in verse 30. But again, God's word in verse 30 has been selected for the chiasm. The Lord's word in verse 26 is ignored, and symmetry has again been achieved. If Alma's words in verse 1 and God's word in verse 30 qualify as elements, it is unclear why Alma's words in verse 3 and the Lord's word in verse 26 do not also qualify as elements, except that to pair them with each other would create asymmetry, and thus they are ignored. Alma's words in verses 1 and 3 and the Lord's word in verses 26 and 30 are better matches than Alma's words with the Lord's word, but to pair them would create asymmetry, and so they are not paired. Such selectivity occurs time and again. Now, this is but a small sampling of the problem with the Alma 36 chiasm. I'm going to leave chiasmus. I'm going to go on to Hebraisms, which is the second area of research. John Tevednus seems to be the most closely associated with Hebraisms in the Book of Mormon. Now, Hebraisms are atypical English that reflect the Hebrew language left behind when the book was translated. Tevednus has identified 13 categories of Hebraisms and several dozens of examples. He seems to have ignored any explanation for his Hebraisms other than as vestiges of ancient Hebrew. There is much to suggest that there are better explanations. Tevednus seems to have ignored the possibility that many Hebraisms could have been taken directly from the Bible. For example, under the category he labels cognates, he identifies dreamed a dream, where the verb and the noun are from the same stem, a root. He identifies dreamed a dream rather than had a dream, and even cites Genesis 37:5 as, quote, exactly the way that the same idea is expressed in literal translation of the Old Testament Hebrew. Now, Genesis 37:5 is the account of Joseph's famous dream, in which dreamed a dream is used 5 times, rather than the non-cognate had a dream. It is possible that Joseph Smith borrowed not only the cognate expression, but the story idea itself, since, like Joseph, Lehi dreamed a dream about the future of his family. Both dreams anticipated events that later occurred. And again, like Joseph, Lehi introduced his dream with, "Behold, I have dreamed a dream." Now, unlike the dreamed-a-dream example, the biblical source itself is often right in the Book of Mormon. Genesis 37:5 is not in the Book of Mormon. For example, under the category Tevednus labels adverbials, he explains that where English will use an adverb such as righteously, Hebrew often uses a prepositional phrase with the preposition meaning in or with, such as in righteousness rather than righteously. But his example of in righteousness at 1 Nephi 21 is taken directly from Isaiah at 48:1, not in truth nor in righteousness. In righteousness is also used six times in the Book of Commandments, the predecessor to the Doctrine and Covenants, and which was not translated from the Hebrew. A close look at some of Tevednus' examples actually suggests a single author. For example, he cites as a cognate Nephi's quotation, "I will work a great and a marvelous work." This expression mutates into a wonderful mixture of cognate and non-cognate expressions used by God, Nephi, Ammon, and Mormon, containing either a great and marvelous work or just a marvelous work. The Book of Commandments also contains the expression, "I will work a marvelous work." And three instances of similar cognates not mentioned by Tevednus are work coupled with curious workmanship, used in the writings of Nephi, Mormon, and Moroni. These are just some of hundreds of phrases used by two or more writers that suggest a single author. Another of Tevednus' cognates suggests still a new problem. Not only could "cursed with a sore cursing" in 2 Nephi and Jacob have been borrowed from Malachi, which is quoted in the book of, in 3 Nephi, and not only does the cognate occur in the Book of Commandments, but that God would curse the Lamanites with a dark skin sounds more like the 19th century attitude toward Native American savages than the Word of God. Under the category Tevednus labels the conjunction, he gives several examples of overuse of the conjunction, which is apparently characteristic of Hebrew but not of English. For example, where in English we would usually say, "in all manner of wood, iron, copper, brass, steel, gold, silver, and precious ores." In 2 Nephi, this reads, "in all manner of wood, and of iron, and of copper, and of brass, and of so forth." But the Book of Commandments is replete with conjunctionitis. Take this beauty: "How oft have I called upon you by the mouth of my servants, and by the ministering of angels, and by mine own voice, and by the voice of thunderings, and by the voice of lightnings," and on, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, another 8 or 9 of them. Another problem with Tevednus' Hebraisms is that some of them may simply be poor English grammar. Under the category he labels the relative clause, he gives several examples where the relative clause, beginning with "which" or "who," that refers back to something previously, does not always closely follow the word it refers back to, as it usually does in English. For example, in 1 Nephi we read, "the Egyptians were drowned in the Red Sea, who were the armies of Pharaoh." Whereas better English, as Tevednus rightly suggests, would be, "the Egyptians, who were the armies of Pharaoh, were drowned in the Red Sea." "Who were the armies of Pharaoh" follows "the Egyptians." It's the relative clause. Not only might such awkward constructions easily occur among unedited writings and first dictations, and I heard one in a presentation this morning, one of these, by one of the speakers, and I've probably committed a few myself, but they are not difficult to find in the Book of Commandments. For example, "Wherefore let my disciples in Kirtland arrange their temporal concerns which dwell upon this farm," rather than "Wherefore let my disciples in Kirtland who dwell upon this farm arrange their temporal concerns." To find Hebraisms in what may be just poor grammar seems unwarranted. Another problem with Tevednus' Hebraisms is that the Hebrew form is not used consistently. For example, under the category he labels naming conventions, Tevednus says that in English we say, "we named or called him X." But in Hebrew it is the name that is called and not the child or place. His biblical example is, "behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son and shall call his name Emmanuel," rather than "call him Emmanuel." He gives four instances of the 12 in the Book of Mormon, such as "we did call the name of the place Shazer." Not only is it possible that Joseph Smith again borrowed this form from such well-known biblical examples as the one quoted by Tevednus, which is found in the Book of Mormon, as well as Isaiah's, "and his name shall be called," rather than "and he shall be called," "and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor," and so forth, which is also found in the Book of Mormon, but the Hebrew form is not used consistently. For example, we read in 1 Nephi, "we called the place Bountiful," rather than "we called the name of the place Bountiful." If, as Tevedna says, in Hebrew it is the name that is called and not the child or place, it is unclear why the Hebrew form is not used consistently. Indeed, the English form of most of Tevedna's examples in all 13 categories usually predominates over the Hebrew. Finally, in a few but very few instances, there is not a ready explanation for what Tevedna calls a Hebraism. For example, under the final category, which he labels words used in unusual ways, Tevedna notes that Jacob wrote that I should engrave in the heads of them upon these plates. Now, heads is an unusual word and is not even used in any of Tevedna's biblical examples, where chief or precious is used rather than heads. Now, I've speculated on a couple of reasons why Jacob used the term, but I like what one Hebrew scholar who reviewed my underlying paper wrote. He says, if heads is not an ancient Hebrew, how can it be called a Hebraism? To what extent does Tevedna seem willing to call any odd language in the Book of Mormon a Hebraism? In short, it is not at all clear that a literal translation from the ancient Hebrew is the best explanation for the Hebraisms identified by Tevedna. Many of them could have been borrowed from the Bible. Significantly, many of them also occur in the Book of Commandments, which was not a translation from the ancient Hebrew. Some of them are simply poor English. Some of them even suggest a 19th century perspective, such as the curse on the Lamanites. There are other unique explanations for some of them. Rarely is there not an easy explanation. In all, they seem to reflect no more than the vagaries of dictation and Joseph Smith's scriptural style, which he patterned after the Bible. Incidentally, I should mention Robert Pattison's delightful parody of Farm's writing in the winter 2000 issue of Dialogue. That was the issue before last, even though it's a winter 2000. Entitled Hebraicisms, Chiasmus, and Other Internal Evidence for Ancient Authorship in Green Eggs and Ham. Yes, this is Dr. Seuss's Green Eggs and Ham, in which Pattison has found Hebraisms, Chiasmus, and other internal evidence of its ancient authorship. Pattison makes the same point in 5 humorous pages that I have taken 10 sober ones to make. Let's go on to the last subject, Mesoamerican geography. John Sorensen's Mesoamerican geography, incidentally, there have been at least 2 sessions this symposium on geography. Very interesting, I think. John Sorensen's Mesoamerican geography for Book of Mormon events challenges the traditional Western Hemisphere geography, which is still widely accepted within the church, with South America as the land southward, North America as the land northward, Panama as the narrow neck of land connecting them, and the Hill Cumorah near Palmyra, New York. Sorensen has argued for many years for a limited geography of a few hundred miles in diameter, located in southern Mexico and southern Guatemala, with the Isthmus of Tehuantepec as the narrow neck and, excuse my Spanish, Cerro El Vigía in the Tuxtlas Mountains in southern Mexico as the Hill Cumorah. His is the only one of a number of limited geography models, to my knowledge, to have gained a following, including many Farms scholars. Under his theory, both the Jaredites and the Nephites were relatively small cultures of people surrounded by other peoples already in the Western Hemisphere when they arrived and who mixed with them. His theory thus accommodates the scientific view that Native Americans are descended from nomads who crossed the Bering Strait land bridge from Asia to North America some thousands of years before the Jaredites arrived. It also explains the 1,500 or so Indian languages at the time of Columbus, which Sorensen himself agrees could not all have derived from Lehi's Hebrew in 1,000 years. It also explains the large explicit and implied population sizes in the Book of Mormon. And since most action in the Book of Mormon takes place just south of the narrow neck, it also enables Sorensen to correlate Book of Mormon cities and such with Mayan ruins. And ruins, apparently, there are none just below Panama in South America, in Colombia specifically. I don't know, but I haven't heard of any. I will briefly comment on, well, it's going to be four, it's going to be three aspects of Sorensen's geography, and I'll explain that when I get there, based only on internal evidence. Others have challenged other aspects of Sorensen's limited geography based on external evidence. I'm limiting myself to what I can find in the Book of Mormon first. Sorensen adopts a model of a few hundred miles in diameter, comprising both the lands northward and southward, with the rest of the Western Hemisphere inhabited by indigenous people, as indeed it was. But even though Sorensen rightly has the main Nephite history occur in a relatively limited area south of the Narrow Neck, where missionaries could preach and armies could skirmish from city to city, this does not preclude the entire North American continent from being the land northward, standing empty and available for the eventual Nephite expansion and final battle, as the internal evidence suggests. Both the Jaredites and the Nephites include North America as part of their promised land. The Jaredites repeatedly describe their land as choice above all other lands, their promised land as choice above all other lands, and this is the same language used by Nephi and Lehi in describing their promised land, which was quite specifically North America. Since Nephi sees in a vision the pilgrims, the Revolutionary War, and the coming forth of the Book of Mormon on the promised land, repeatedly, Nephi refers to their being in the promised land, even though they were in the land southward. There is no differentiation between where they are and the promised land they describe. It is all one. Their thinking is continental, if not hemispheric. All of the references to the land northward are consistent with its being North America. For example, when the Nephites finally begin to people the land south, northward, they travel to an exceeding great distance, although Sorensen limits the land northward to a couple of hundred miles north of the Narrow Neck. The Nephites eventually spread so that they cover the land from the sea south to the sea north and from the sea west to the sea east, which describes the hemisphere or even North America, but not Sorensen's Mesoamerica. Sorensen's only recognition of this perspective is when Ether tells the people that the New Jerusalem would be built on this land. Sorensen recognizes that this land cannot be taken literally because the New Jerusalem would have to be near the narrow neck of land where Ether was. So Ether must be speaking in general terms of the whole continent. In other words, Ether's this land meant the North American continent, which Sorensen recognizes. Sorensen otherwise ignores the internal evidence of a hemispheric perspective. Now, my second comment relates to the 120-mile-wide Isthmus of Tehuantepec as the Narrow Neck, rather than the 40-mile-wide Panama. It has many problems. Even assuming that the Nephites would consider the slight indentation on the southern coast of Mexico to create a neck, you've got to recognize that Mexico comes down like this and the rest of Central America and then falls into South America. Now, as it comes down, it goes up over the Yucatan Peninsula. So, and this is the Gulf of Mexico or the Gulf of Campeche specifically, on the north of Mexico. As it comes down then, there's a little indentation right opposite the Gulf of Campeche, and that's the Gulf of Isthmus of Tehuantepec. Even assuming that the Nephites would consider the slight southern indentation on the southern coast of Mexico to create a neck, it is doubtful they would consider it a narrow neck when it is 120 miles wide and not much narrower than the lands on either side of it. To meet the requirement that a Nephite can traverse the neck in a day and a half, Sorensen suggests that the distance might be from garrison to garrison, some miles inland, or that it might be by messenger relay, and that we don't know the mode of travel. Of interest, however, is that in several, I could say many other contexts, where he is trying to determine the distance between places, none of his many conjectures on the distance traveled in a couple of days approaches 120 miles. For example, he writes, 3 days' journey to the north brought Alma to Ammonihah, perhaps 30 to 40 miles. Now, he's always trying to determine the distance between cities. And you can only do that by days of travel, essentially. They don't use distances in the Book of Mormon, as you all well know. Also across the narrow neck was only a day and a half's journey. This is the only distance in the Book of Mormon modified by only, which suggests it was indeed narrow. In at least two instances, the distance from the narrow neck to Cumorah, which Sorensen puts at 100 miles, is described as so far northward in the Book of Mormon and an exceeding great distance. It seems incongruous for Mormon to describe the 120-mile distance across the Isthmus of Tehuantepec as only the distance of a day and a half's journey, while describing Sorensen's 100 miles to Cumorah as so far northward and an exceeding great distance. This language would work, however, if the narrow neck were Panama and Cumorah were in New York. Another problem with Sorensen's narrow neck is that it should connect the land northward with the land southward, nearly surrounded by water. South America meets this requirement precisely because it is surrounded by water, except where Panama links South America to Costa Rica and the rest of Central and North America. What is puzzling is why Sorensen believes southern Mexico and southern Guatemala meet this requirement. Neither individually nor together are they nearly surrounded by water. Sorensen himself says his geography is bounded on two sides by oceans and does not explain how his Mesoamerican location meets the criterion of being nearly surrounded by water. And a last problem that I'll mention with the Isthmus of Tehuantepec is their orientation, which is more west and east than north and south. Sorensen's solution is that what the Nephites called north and south was more west and east by our compass directions, thereby accommodating the nearly west-east orientation of his Mesoamerican setting to the Book of Mormon's north-south orientation. There is little north, land northward, land southward. There is little in the Book of Mormon from which to determine what the directional model was, but everything is consistent with north meaning our north. Certainly when Lehi broke camp near the Red Sea, he traveled in nearly a south-southeast direction near the Red Sea, which matches the orientation of the Red Sea under our directional system. He then traveled nearly eastward, which LDS scholars have consistently taken to mean our eastward. The Jaredites apparently have the same directional model, since they too refer to the land northward and the land southward. It seems likely that these disparate people based their directional system on the rising and setting sun rather than some environmental factor suggested by Sorensen. I'm hurrying as fast as I can. Let me say just one other thing about the... In summary, Sorensen's Isthmus of Tehuantepec fares poorly as the narrow neck. It is hardly a neck at all. It is hardly narrow. It does not connect the land northward with the land southward, nearly surrounded by water, and it is oriented askew. Panama, on the other hand, satisfies the criteria in the Book of Mormon perfectly. My third and last comment, and then I'll conclude, is that not only does nothing in the Book of Mormon suggest there were other people, but some internal evidence which Sorensen has ignored indicates there were no other people. The Book of Mormon embraces the literal biblical account of history in the book of Genesis from God's creation of the world through the flood to the Tower of Babel, where God dispersed people upon the face of all the earth, including the Jaredites, who take with them, when they go to the promised land, flocks, male and female of every kind, fowls of the air, fish of the waters in a special vessel, swarms of bees and seed of every kind, as if going to an empty promised land. Sorensen ignores this entire context. Sorensen also ignores Lehi's deathbed words to his family that they were in essence alone in the land, meaning at least North America. And Sorensen ignores the recognition throughout the Book of Mormon that the inhabitants were referred to as Israelites out of Jerusalem. Jacob, Ammon, Helaman, General Moroni, 3rd Nephi, Mormon, and even God's voice and Jesus all tell the people in various ways that they are a branch of the house of Israel. If there were indigenous peoples who mixed with the Nephites or Lamanites, they are entirely ignored in the many references to everyone as Israelites out of Jerusalem. I was going to talk about the survival of Jaredites, but that's Nibley's argument which Sorensen adopts. So I'm going to conclude here. I recognize that acceptance of the historicity of the Book of Mormon is not typically based on evidence and reason, but on faith and prayer. As Sorensen has written, neither through his early college courses in the sciences or later, did I have to ask, is this volume true? I never asked external support for the private confirmation I already enjoyed. And Welch says the same thing about farms. They're not trying to prove the Book of Mormon true with evidence. Welch says that nothing can replace the Holy Ghost in bearing witness to the truth. Nevertheless, when farm scholars write as scholars, they should observe the standards of scholarship, much as the new historians have largely done, and leave apologetics to others. But in my opinion, speaking chiastically, their analyses derive from their conviction rather than their conviction from their analyses. My best guess is that farm scholars simply start with the basic assumption of the historicity of the Book of Mormon and gather evidence to support their assumption. But this is not the way of sound scholarship. Okay, I'm going to stop there. Kevin, give you a little time so we can have some questions and answers. Thank you.
Well, I got the invitation a couple of weeks ago, since I was going to be here anyway. So I've done Sunstone. As I say, this is my eighth Sunstone panel, so I'm getting used to this. He nobly said that a professor is not one who knows, but one who professes to know, and therefore invites challenge from all comers. And the first thing I did for farms. Oh, by the way. All of the things I have done for farms up to this point were unsolicited. Nobody asked me. So you don't need to be invited. However, it does need to be good. The first thing I did for farms was a review of Dan Vogel's Indian Origins in the Book of Mormon. And 12 years later... Well, actually, in the meantime, a few years later, Vogel objected to something that I said in that, so he wrote an article in New Approaches. on Universalism in the Book of Mormon, responding in turn to something that I'd said. And then I wrote another review later called Paradigms Crossed in the review Volume 7, Number 2, which reacted to that. And then lately he's responded again to some of my stuff in both in... American Apocrypha, and in a response on his website. There should be, and there is, a give and take in scholarship. That's the point. One book, one article, as Nibley says, doesn't settle anything. It's an ongoing discussion. Well, I'm just amazed. We're fair game. I'm fair game for anybody. But what I'm puzzled with is why this institution, I'm seeing a tendency now to institutionalize a complete marginalizing of farms. I mean, as individuals, I think, sure, it's fair game, but why call it farms? Why not call it me, or why not call it Welch or Tvedness or Nibley, you know? Nibley's one of my heroes, and I can count 4 reviews in the review of the books on the Book of Mormon that criticized his work. How dare they criticize my hero? Well, that's the way of scholarship. That's the way things work. But some of these specific things here. Chiasmus. I noticed that... I have to get one of my visual aids. By the way, the essays that he's criticizing can be found in this book, 2 of them. The one on Hebraisms. This is Rediscovering the Book of Mormon. Insights you may have been missed before, edited by John Sorensen and Melvin Thorne. They were published separately, the copy I got didn't have footnotes, but I've been on the farm's mailing list for 23 years, so it was really fairly easy for me to find this stuff. Alma 36 as a masterpiece. This is quoting from John Welch here. In this book on page 129, level 5 degree of chiasticity. We are now in a position to see how complex the chiasm of ALMA 36 really is. Chiasms can occur in any literature, but they only become meaningful when its degree of chiasticity is high. Only when the chiastic format is truly complex and concise are we justified in supposing that the author intentionally followed the pattern. Judged by the following criteria, the degree of chiasmus in ALMA 36 is extremely high and can be best explained by concluding that ALMA learned it as part of a long literary tradition extending back to the Old Testament prophets. And I'll just read the criteria that he cites: objectivity, purpose, climax, centrality, boundaries, length, density, and dominance. For this one, he says, ALMA 36 contains 1,230 total words, around 175 figure directly in the chiasm, and these 175 are substantial, not minor words in the text. He says, mavericks and random repetition. A chiasm is less convincing if important words in the structure appear elsewhere in the text, outside the suggested arrangement. ALMA 36 meets this rule very well. For example, of 30 key structural words, only 3 words, word commandment and no, ever appear outside their respective sections. There is very little random repetition of these 30 words or any other word in ALMA 36. He cites balance. ALMA 36 exhibits a strong degree of balance. The first half contains 52.4% of the words and the second half 47.6%. Even minor words like behold, 6 times in each half, my, 18 times in the first half and 17 in the second, occur equally in the two halves. Return, ALMA 36 conveys a powerful sense of completeness. It clearly returns to the ideas with which it began. Stylistic compatibility, aesthetics, setting, and intentionality. So he has, elsewhere, Welch has an article citing 15 proposed criteria for the existence of chiasmus. And I would recommend, if Earl was going to keep working on his paper, that he should deal with those specific criteria, so that there's a common ground for criticizing. And as I say, when Don Perry did the parallelisms in the Book of Mormon formatted, they found over 300 chiasms in the Book of Mormon. But as he explains in the introduction, there were a number of them that they folded that could have been argued to be a chiasm, but they didn't feel were strong enough, so that they just formatted them as regular text. And it was on the basis of criteria that they're making these selections. Now, I found myself, when I was formatting ALMA 36 for an article that I wrote, Nigh Unto Death, NDE Research in the Book of Mormon, it was originally a Sunstone presentation. So am I a Farms writer? Am I a Sunstone writer? I found that when I put it together, without reference to what Welch had done, it came out differently. But I was still impressed. And Welch has put out a paper for Farms with about 5 or 6 different proposed arrangements for ALMA 36. And in his article on style, there's a passage where he makes this comparison between chiasmus and jazz music that I think is really lovely, coming from a lawyer. That this sense, there's a sense of beauty and flow that goes with part of what I think makes it astonishingly beautiful. Okay, well, a couple of other points here. A chiasmus doesn't have to be as precise as a palindrome. Comparison with other biblical literatures show that. So I think there's something that I notice that I call arbitrary, unfulfilled expectations in dealing with prophets. And my example story of this is in the Bible, there's the story of Jesus, and Lazarus is said to have died, and people are heard to say, well, he healed all of these other people. Could not he have prevented his friend from dying? And there's the sense where nothing that he could do is ever going to be quite good enough. You can always ask for more. And I think that in and of itself, there's a quote from N.R. Hansen that Thomas Kuhn uses a lot. All data is theory laden. That whatever framework, whatever approach we have is going to affect what we see. For example, in the paper at one point he said that there are some passages in the Book of Mormon that sounded more like a 19th century attitude toward Native Americans than the Word of God. Well, if you look up, if you've got the Bible D and you do a search on darkness and blackness, In the Old Testament, you find things coming up, and the time in which they come up tends to be around Lehi's time. There's a very good one in the Lamentations of Jeremiah where it talks about the Nazarites who used to be pure as milk, but now after the fall of Jerusalem, then they're cursed with this blackness. Well, that was a characteristic way of talking that they had. So it does actually fit the ancient context. And the good news is it doesn't mean what we think it means. It's not racist. It's referring to a fallen morality. Okay. Let's see. A few more notes here. Sorensen's... I don't want to get into this, but Sorensen has done other things like Mormon's Map, this book that says completely internal geography of the Book of Mormon. I think, and he's what Sorensen is recognizing, there's all this diversity in models of the Book of Mormon geography, and I think he very rightly points out that the place to start is to get the internal model correct. And so he's got this one, that's his most recent one, plus this one is actually a lot of fun, if you're really interested. Is the Geography of Book of Mormon Events, a source book, and he goes through, there are 700 statements in the Book of Mormon that convey geographic information. And whatever model that we come up with that works has to satisfy all of them. And, for example, let's see. Oh, there's a couple of quotes I wanted to give from. I'm going to quote myself. There's some criticism of the Book of Mormon not mentioning any others. Well, this is the review of the books on the Book of Mormon, Volume 2, Number 7. And I've got a review in here called Paradigms Crossed. I'm just wondering how much time I have to tell the story about how I wrote this. I came home from a vacation in Utah with new approaches to the Book of Mormon. And when I got to work, my boss looked up at me and called me to her office and said that I was laid off. So I had that book and I had time on my hands. So I spent about 14 hours a day for 3 months working on this review. And about halfway through it, I said to my wife one day, I said, I think I'm doing something important here. And I think as soon as I finish, I'll have a job. And I popped, when I finished, it was a long manuscript, and unsolicited again, they didn't ask me for this, I popped it in the mailbox, and I drove up to my new job. But Michael Quinn said that this was one of the best examples of Mormon scholarship defending the Book of Mormon. He called it incisive. He didn't call me an apologist, and I think I know why. It's because I'm not on his shit list yet. But it depends on the scriptures. Okay, so I want to get to this passage in here where I talk about some of the good arguments for there being other people around. I should have dog-eared it. I can tell you one of the best things that I think is when Nephi is talking about the words of Isaiah, and he says, many of my people don't understand the words of the Isaiah because they don't know anything about the ways of the Jews. I haven't taught them. If they're all Jews there, it doesn't make any sense. And I went through, there's places in here where I go through, and I look very carefully, specifically, at Lehi's blessing to his children and those chapters, and I show specifically in those chapters many places where there are very strong indications of other people around. Things that don't make any sense otherwise. And Brent Gardner has been doing some really good stuff on this just lately, which I may not have time to get to. I will quote, though, one thing from Brent Gardner on this. He said that as far as the Mesoamerican setting for the Book of Mormon, he said, many Mesoamericanists, including myself, have made a fundamental error in looking at the Book of Mormon. He says, we've been looking for the Book of Mormon in Mesoamerica instead of looking for Mesoamerica in the Book of Mormon. And he says, surprisingly, this makes a huge difference in the nature and quality of the correlations. He says, suddenly, everything makes more sense. Suddenly, the discourses have a meaning and a context in which there's something going on. Like Jacob's quotation of these prophecies of Isaiah about the Gentiles acting as nursing fathers to Israel if there are other people around, it makes sense. There are things about that he points out. In Jacob's time, the complaint about people all of a sudden wearing costly apparel and the show of wealth. If you're a colony only of 30 or 40 people, that doesn't make any sense. But if you're interacting, trading with other people, then all of this makes sense. You know, things like Sorensen pointing out, corn is a Native American plant, and it has to be cultivated. It can't survive by itself. And the Nephites start planting corn. They had to have gotten that from somebody, and that somebody had to have been there. So I would disagree that I think there are very strong indications all the way through the Book of Mormon of other people around. And I've noted some in my articles, and Sorensen has, and Brant Gardner is doing some excellent work on that. But I do want to say that this about farms, it's open season on anything any scholar writing for farms. You know, there's nothing that I think that any of us have written that is sacrosanct or perfect. But I think if we're going to be criticized, we should be criticized as individual scholars, and individual arguments should be criticized, and to not be dismissed as a body for something that an individual has done, no matter how offensive you may find that personally, because we've all done stuff. You know, everybody's done something that offends somebody. Jesus said, "Blessed is he who is not offended in me." And he said lots of things that would offend people. But I'm here, I've been coming to Sunstone, sharing things that I think are important to share. I come because I'm enthusiastic about them. And I'm enthusiastic about the Book of Mormon. And the things that I've written are the product of my enthusiasm for that book. And I want to come here, I feel like when I'm all lit up like a candle, I want to touch someone and I want to see that light go onto someone else. I want to give it away. And I'm thankful that I've been able to come and share at least something. You may not agree with me, but thanks for at least the chance of letting me talk. Thank you.
We are just about out of time, but I'm going to take the presumption to ask the one question if Earl would like to respond on the particular issue of generalizing to farms instead of focusing on particular authors.
Thank you. I think Kevin's point is well made. So much of what I have read comes out of farms, and it's easy to refer to everyone as farms. But you're absolutely right. We have to critique individual authors, which I did in my paper, although I put them all under the umbrella of farms. And if I'm mistaken in that, I apologize. But I will also say that so much of the research that comes out of farms publications, and they do publish this research, I've looked at so much of it, and when I'm able to test a farms publication against the Book of Mormon, it often, too often, ends up unreliable.
I would just offer the further thought that what occurred to me is that sometimes at Sunstone we get caught up a little bit in our clever titles that we use for these sessions, and the parallel with last year's session on Farms Review of Books, then this year Farms Research generally. Well, that's the end of our session in its formal sense. If you would like to ask individual questions of our presenters, thank you very much for being here, and thanks to the presenters.